Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. 50 years ago today, January 13th, 1972, Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, walked into the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles to record what to this day is the best-selling gospel album of all time, Amazing Grace. It was made with Reverend James Cleveland and the Southern California Community Choir over the course of 2 days in front of a live audience, one that included people from Aretha's father to Mick Jagger. The result? Well, let's just listen to a bit of a performance. That was Climbing Higher Mountains, sung by Aretha Franklin. A documentary called Amazing Grace features never-before-seen footage of the sessions. And on this 50th anniversary of the recording, we are revisiting my 2019 conversation with Amazing Grace producers Alan Elliott and Terrell Whitley about the album and the making of the film. I started by asking Alan when he first learned about the existence of the footage from the concert.
Back in 1990, I was a staff record producer at Atlantic Records, back when there was a record business.
I remember.
You remember. you were much later in the whole process. But in 1990, there was a record business, and I was a staff record producer at Atlantic. And Jerry Wexler, who became a very good friend and my mentor, and he said to me at a certain point, he said, "Well, we filmed Amazing Grace." And then I was like, "Oh, what?"
Huh?
And he's like, yeah, we filmed it. And I was like, "Well, what was it?" And he's like, "Well, Sidney Lumet." I said, "Really? Sidney Lumet?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "In Los Angeles?" He said, "Yeah, Sidney Lumet." I said, "You sure it wasn't Sidney Pollack?" "Oh, yeah, that was it, Sidney Pollack." And so it was sort of this. And then he said something which, you know, it becomes these prophecy things. He said, "You're the Don Quixote type. Why don't you go find out about it?" And so that started it in 1990. And then in 2007, I got serious about it. In 1990, we had a conversation with Sidney about it, and we got a little bit involved, but we didn't really get into it. And in 2007, my wife was pregnant, and I needed a life raft off the record business Titanic. And I thought about it, and it came up, and I called Jerry, and he said, let's do it. And so then I was introduced to Sidney Pollack, and he said the same thing. And then the journey began in what I thought was going to be a couple months.
You thought it would be straightforward.
It seemed like
footage,
a good idea at the time.
Seems like the story writes itself. It's a concert. It's a church gathering. But there were problems with the footage.
You know, while Sidney was alive, he never told me that the footage could not be sunk together. So we would have these sort of theoretical conversations about what would the movie be like. And at a certain point, my wife is getting more pregnant. So I was like, what's it actually look? What's it look like? And he just wanted to have these theoretical conversations, which were great. But at a certain point, there was the master apprentice thing sort of got flipped, because at a certain point he said to me, "We should go to Quincy's house and we'll film Quincy Jones." And I was like, "No, let's not do that." And it was a hard conversation, but it was like our first fight. And then he got pancreatic cancer, and it was just like the aggressive kind. So it went very quickly. Mm-hmm. And the next conversation we had, he called me, and his assistant said, "Alan, Sidney wants to talk to you, and he's going to be brutally honest with you." And I was like, "Huh, I wonder what that means." And I knew he was sick. So I started the conversation with, "Sydney, I'm so sorry you're sick." And he said, "I'm not sick, Alan. I'm effing dying." And I was like, "Okay." And it was that, because he was, you know, he's a powerful guy. Mm-hmm. And he had that method actor thing too. So he knew he was freezing me in the tracks. But he was generous in the next sentence, which is, he said, "I realize that you know this better than I do. So I went to the studio and I told him to let you finish it. So I want you to go do it." And that was sort of like the end of our relationship, because we've already established he's about to die. Mm-hmm. He's given me this gift, and he sort of kicked me out of the nest, and he does know that I know it better than he does, and go get him. And so that was that.
So I want you to explain to folks why this footage was sitting at Warner Brothers. I mean, that's the question. Like, this footage is great. You have Sidney Pollack. It's Aretha Franklin. Surely somebody, before you, Alan, no offense, would jump into this project.
Yeah, I think that what we understand is that the technical difficulties were at such a state, and I think Sidney kind of held tight to it. He knew this was a special event and a special scenario with Aretha, but there were so many technical things that were out of sync that after Warner had already given an attempt to try to bring things together. So there was an attempt on their side. They hired Alexander Hamilton to do some lip reading to try to sync up some of the footage. They got through, 10% of it. And at that juncture, just based on cost, time, energy, and effort, I think folks just kind of decided this was not going to be a worthwhile task. And at that juncture, I think the folks at Warner kind of felt like, and when you look at it, they had already gone on to do an amazing album, not an okay album, mm-hmm. an amazing album that sold, millions of copies. And so when you look at Aretha and what she had done with Amazing Grace, there was already this testament of greatness that had already been accomplished. And with the challenges on the other side with the film, I think it was somewhat easier to say, hey, let's kind of let that subside, mm-hmm. and we'll just focus over here.
And for our folks who are in the film business and the TV business, we'll appreciate this. And we keep saying it's out of sync. Sidney Pollack, those clapboards everybody sees? That's not just for the movies. That's not for show. That's to sync up the audio and video. And for whatever reason, that didn't happen, right?
He wasn't the original director that was hired.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah, there was another director. Woodstock had saved the film company. They had this film company, and then in the late 60s, films were getting... It was a tough time for the film business in the late 60s. And so Steve Ross bought Warner 7 Arts, and then they started buying record companies. And they had Warner Brothers Records at the time. They bought Atlantic Records for... I think it was $18 million in 1967, which is a lot of money. And $18 million was a number came up again in Woodstock, which is they did Woodstock. They bought Woodstock for $100,000, and it was the biggest grossing movie of 1970. It made $18 million, which was like a Defense Department budget at those times. So they were looking for different ways to put the film company together with the record company. And they had hired our partner, a guy named Joe Boyd, who actually ended up producing the movie with us 47 years later. And at the time, he was hired as the head of, to be the liaison between the record company and the film company, and to make more Woodstocks, because Woodstock, now it's corporate synergy. Let's make more stuff. Mm-hmm. So... this was the first one, and Joe had hired another director, a guy named Jim Signorelli. And Jim Signorelli went on to direct all the Saturday Night Live videos, the cartoons, the commercials, mm-hmm. for the first 35 years. He did, like, Little Chocolate Donuts and those kind of things. And he had done Superfly. And Superfly was interesting because it required a very specific skill set as the director of photography, which was Jim's job, because you had Curtis Mayfield doing live performances and dialogue going on while the performances were going on, which is a pretty radical way of doing it. So you have live performances and you have, performances going on by the actors. So Joe, being a really smart guy, hired this guy. And then Sidney Pollack went over his head and had dinner with the head of the studio and got the job. and wanted to do it and had never done it before. And, you know, there's an incredible duality in the movie, which is you have these cameras flying around, which in the old days you were supposed to be anchored because you had to have your clapper and you had to be close for sync and all that sort of stuff. So the duality is that obviously they couldn't sync the footage in 1972, but in 2008, when we finally got the stuff sunk together, then you have this incredible movement and you have this ability to capture her in incredible close-ups. And
the technology made it possible, something that they couldn't have done back there because it was too expensive, was able to do now. I want to get to Michael real quick. He's been holding, and he's got an Aretha. He's got an Aretha comment. Hi, Michael.
Hey, I appreciate all you guys do, and thanks for bringing this to fruition.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
30 seconds quickly, you mentioned Curtis Mayfield. I got to be on an episode of New York Undercover with him when he was the guest and got the pleasure of meeting him and hearing him sing. But Aretha, which my father calls Uretha, he doesn't understand her name. The funniest, coolest thing I ever heard about her is she used to always get paid in cash and keep her pocketbook on the stage.
Oh, yes.
Even though she's wearing mink coats. Is that true? Do you guys know about that?
Well, she's very specific with her business dealings. And so I do know Aretha would always make sure her contracts or her that there was a payment up front. She was never someone you paid at the end. And there are many, many scenarios where her pocketbook would be with her on stage. So, you know, as a businesswoman, and someone that was, you know, very much so focused on how to deliver her performance, but also handle her business at the same time, Aretha made sure all was done in proper and order and excellence.
And we've gone to the film company and we are getting paid in cash now.
and he does have a pocketbook.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. My guests are Alan Elliott and Terrell Whitley. So anybody who's read about this documentary knows that Aretha Franklin knew about the footage. She really didn't want the footage to be put out there. Do we know why?
Not really. I think, and she loved the movie. I mean,
she did love it. She did say she loved it, but she didn't want it out there initially.
Yeah, and we've all talked about it, even with the Franklin family. And I think, you know, one of the things that we looked at is the fact that, again, there was this other part to it. There was this album that had gone on to do exceptionally well. This film was not perfect in certain aspects of it technically, and the visuals of how Sydney captured it. There's a lot of frames out of focus and things are moving around. She's a perfectionist, and she really looked for this film to be a space to catapult her into a movie star. And I don't think, you know, that it accomplished that for her. And then after a while, you know, after years begin to pass, I think she was over it. I mean, I think this was behind her. She's like, hey, I've moved on. Let's move on. But the reality of it is that Alan produced and the team pulled together to produce, I think, an amazing piece of art. And I think that when she saw it, that was a testament, you know, for her to say, yes, I really do love the film.
There's a lot of stuff that happened. I mean, this is the craziest journey. This is the craziest show business story anyone will ever live through. And if anybody calls and has a crazier one, good luck. So here's like things that, you know, you don't get the information until it's later down the line. People often ask this question, right? And they say, well, why was she mad at you, Alan? And I'm like, well, I was 7 years old when she made the movie, so I don't think she's really mad at me. She's probably mad about the fact that she didn't get to be a movie star because Diana Ross got to be a movie star that year with Lady Sings the Blues and was nominated for an Academy Award, and Barbara Streisand got to do The Way We Were later that year. And, you know, we couldn't figure it out for years because we were doing everything we could to, you know, we didn't start this process to poke a finger in the eye of Aretha Franklin. And 3 years ago or so, I became close with Sabrina Owens, who's the executor of the will, and Aretha's niece. And we were trying to make a deal with Lionsgate movie company, and we had a deal, and Aretha wouldn't sign it, and we couldn't figure out why. And at some point Sabrina called me and said, I got to tell you something between us. And I was like, what's that? She's like, Aretha has pancreatic cancer. She's had it for a couple of years. And then the light bulb goes off, which is you say, oh, I don't want to have that, because it's, you know that she's sick, and you know that you've made her eulogy.
Mm,
I mean,
right.
And do you, I mean, are you expecting her to go do press around her death? Because that's not going to happen, and nor should we ask her. So Sabrina, we sort of huddled and had that conversation. I mean, I didn't even tell Terrell about it for a while, but Sabrina and I really just, we were like, okay, there's nothing to be done right now. And every couple months, Sabrina and I would check in, and Sabrina was like, because we had to keep up our insurance, we had to keep all our stuff going so that if that time came, we would do it. And, Sabrina was really kind. She invited us to come to the funeral after she passed. Mm-hmm. And then a couple weeks after the funeral, she said, why don't you come and show the family the movie? And that was, now we look at it. At the time, we were like, oh, my God, it's like a month later, and it just, oh, well, we could show them the movie now. Mm-hmm. But now we look back on it, and we're like, oh, my God, we were showing them the movie a month after she died.
Right.
And
that's
and
really moving, actually, for
super
them.
Super emotional.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine.
That was my conversation with producers Alan Elliott and Terrell Whitney about the documentary Amazing Grace, which captures the two-day recording sessions of Aretha Franklin's most beloved album, Amazing Grace. Today, January 13th, is the 50th anniversary of that recording session.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.